Warning, this is the Freedom Fiends midweek non-radio podcast. Unlike our weekend live talk radio shows, where we adhere to all regulations and community standards, this cast may contain cussing and or prurient subject matter. If you are easily offended, please leave now. But tune in Saturdays and Sundays to our live talk radio show. If you're not easily offended, prepare to be entertained, informed, and enlightened.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. We're working very hard to spend your tax money to keep you from hearing things like freedomfiends.com.
Okay, we're recording. This is Michael Dean. We got Ben Stone filling in today for Nima Vedati, who is on paternity leave. He's his wife is about a month away from popping out a new ANCAP libertarian into this world, and he needs to spend some time with her tonight. So Ben is filling in today. Ben's also going to be filling in the last half hour, at least on Sunday, because Nima has to go to work. How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm a temp fiend.
A temp fiend. Yeah, we called up the Renta Anarchist Agency, and they sent over Ben.
Renafine.
Yep. So we're talking, for some reason, about Jerry Stahl, the screenwriter and novelist that I like. He's in my movie, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow. He was friends with Selby and influenced by Selby. Jerry Stahl was probably also influenced by Dashiell Hammett, the Sam Spade stuff, and Edgar Allan Poe, and just has a really bizarre sense of humor. And people watch TV and they don't think about that someone actually writes it. And Jerry Stahl was the main writer on the first bunch of seasons of CSI, and I've been rewatching them. And he's really funny. He actually used to write on ALF, you know, the alien that eats cats, and Twin Peaks. And you read a little bit more about him. Read from his bio, which for some reason doesn't have CSI in it. I think Jerry may have removed it. For some reason, he's not proud of that, but I'm proud of him for that, so I'm going to talk about it.
Actually, it looks like they put it back in, or somebody put it back in.
An edit war on Jerry Stahl's Wikipedia page. The edit war was probably with Jerry Stahl. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. Under the career section, it says...
That's funny, because usually when there's an edit war with somebody who their page is about, it's about the editors on Wikipedia trying to remove things that they don't think is noteworthy, that the person is saying, I did these great things. And everyone's like, I've never heard of that. This is the opposite. This is something everyone's heard of that I believe Jerry Stahl may have taken off himself. And the editors on Wikipedia are fighting with him to put it back on. Okay, so go on.
Yeah, in the career section, it says Stahl began publishing short fiction, won a pushcart prize in 1976, and made a living writing for magazines and doing porn stories for cash. one writing job as humor editor for Hustler meant moving to Columbus, Ohio, and living at the YMCA. I can't imagine that.
Hey, Mom, man. I've made it. I've moved to Columbus. I'm living at the Y and writing for Hustler. Yeah.
That'd be a fun call home.
Mm-hmm.
Until the magazine moved its headquarters to California, Stahl lost his job 6 months to the day after taking it, and ended up unemployed. And ended up on unemployment in California alongside an escalating heroin dependency, which eventually led him to contracting
herpetitis.
Hepatitis.
He was a hep cat. Yeah.
Oh man, that's not something to laugh at. But my stumbling.
Well, I've heard him. I've heard him give talks, and he referred to himself as a hep cat, or maybe it was Selby who had hepatitis and referred to himself as a hep cat. One of them did. And Jerry's very self-deprecating and has an extremely dry sense of humor. I've heard him do a bunch of readings. I'm a big fan of his work, and I've interviewed him in his home, in his cavernous mansion. It's not windowless at all. It's got a lot of windows, and it looks out over, I'm not going to say where it is, east side of L.A. He doesn't live in Hollywood. He's like, yeah, I'm not that guy. I live over on the east side. But he lives way up in the hills in a cavernous mansion filled with polydactyl cats. which is kind of interesting because Hemingway had polydactyl cats, you know, cats with six or seven toes. I'm wondering if Jerry Stahl got polydactyl cats because Hemingway had them, or maybe they are from the lineage of Hemingway's cats. Because I know there's somebody who sells, you know, great, 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 great grandsons and daughter cats of Hemingway's cats. Maybe Jerry was like, well, I bought a mansion. What do I get now? Hemingway's cats. Because he is influenced by Hemingway, too, I think.
That would be the natural thing to do, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Either that or go fishing.
What do you get for the ex-junkie? You know, what's the perfect gift for the ex-junkie millionaire who can buy anything but doesn't really buy things except a big empty house? You get him Hemingway's cats, man.
Get him a cat with extra toes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So go on.
Let's see. Permanent Midnight, his 1995 memoir, was adapted by Stahl into a 1998 film of the same name starring Ben Stiller.
Ben Stone.
that raised Stahl's profile and set the stage for his ongoing work in film. He wrote the screenplay for Bad Boys 2, which starred Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. His novel, Perv, His novels, Perv, A Love Story and Plain Clothes Naked, enjoyed moderate success.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I read his book, I, Fatty, which is about, it's fiction based on Fatty Arbuckle, the guy, the early Hollywood silent film star and an early not silent film star who was basically destroyed by the government. Like, this guy, Fatty Arbuckle, started his own studio and was like running Hollywood and ran afoul of, I think it might have been the guy who started the FBI. What's his name?
J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah. And the common knowledge, if you mention Fatty Arbuckle's name, like, do you know anything about him?
Most people will immediately talk about him, a rape and a possible murder of a teenage girl.
Right, right. And there's an alternate theory is that he was set up by the government, and that's the one Jerry goes with. And Jerry writes from the view of Fatty Arbuckle in this alternate fiction or possible true alternate fiction universe about Fatty Arbuckle. It's a really good book.
Was part of the background story on that also that he had upset the magnificently wealthy newspaper guy?
Hearst.
Yeah.
The guy who outlawed marijuana. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was it. It wasn't the FBI. It was Hearst. Yeah.
That's the guy who the movie Citizen Kane was roughly, loosely based on.
Arbuckle's trial was a major media event. Exaggerated and sensationalized stories were run in William Randolph Hearst's nationwide newspaper chain. Hearst was gratified by the Arbuckle scandal and later said that it sold more newspapers than any event since the sinking of the Lusitania. The resulting scandal destroyed Arbuckle's career and personal life. Morality groups called for Arbuckle to be sentenced to death. And studio executives ordered his industry friends and fellow actors not to speak up for him. Charlie Chaplin was in England at the time and therefore not available for comment. Buster Keaton made a public statement in support of Arbuckle's innocence. Yeah, but other than that, he was pretty much blackballed and blacklisted and, yeah, they destroyed him. They destroyed him. Yeah.
Fatty Arbuckle gave Buster Keaton his first start in the movies.
So I just sent you some pictures of Jerry Stahl that I took at a reading in Pasadena at a bookstore. They're kind of cute. And we can share them with the audience by looking at them. It's the top of the page is me with that woman there. Skip down past the women. That's just me getting people to help with the movie. There's a picture of Jerry at a podium speaking into a Shure SM58 microphone. He's reading from I, Fatty in these. They're pretty cool pictures if you scroll down and look at them. I'm trying to find the pictures taken in his home of his polydactyl cats, though, because they're really, really awesome.
Yeah. There's the book. And yep. there's... there's a foot. Oh, I see. That's a foot of one of the ladies that's sitting here.
It's a listening. Foot. Yes, Jerry brings a severed foot to all his readings. No, that's I don't think so. All right, here's the bizarre pictures. Well, they're actually beautiful pictures. They're taken by my friend Lydia Lamb, who was my girlfriend, and then we broke up, and we're still great friends. And she was the witness and photographer and only guest at DJ and my wedding. Because you need to bring your own witness when you get married at the courthouse in California. And she was available, and she's a photographer, so she also took the pictures. But are you looking? Oh, Jerry likes red vines. There's a big box of red vines on his table there. That's his habit. You know, you give up heroin, you buy red vines. But aren't these awesome pictures and awesome cats? Look at these cats.
I like the simplicity of his house, actually.
He may have just moved in, or he may be really zen. I don't know. I mean, it's like a 15-room house on the hills on the east side of L.A., and it's comfortable, but there's, like, very little in it. You know, there's couches, and there's rugs, and there's chairs, and there's desks, and that's pretty much the whole house, and lights.
He has some nice art on the walls, though.
Oh, he does. Yeah, I mean, he is a wealthy man. Hollywood has done well to him because of his self-deprecating sense of humor. I mean, he writes the CSIs, like, one of the ones... He also... Like Fatty Arbuckle, morality groups go after Jerry Stahl. Like, if you search his name and, like, you know, Christian TV or something, there's a bunch of groups that, like, he's their poster child of what's wrong with Hollywood. Because he does episodes where, like, of CSI, he wrote them along. I don't think he writes for them anymore, but he wrote for a long time ago. He actually quit, and then they hired him back. I don't know if they just, like, drove a dump truck of money up to his house or something, but he quit in disgust. And then a few years later came back as a consultant. Like I imagine he was probably still doing some writing, but just didn't want his name. I think he considers like writing TV beneath him and considers himself a novelist. And he's a damn good novelist, but yeah, he does it. Like I wanted to put in the interview on the movie, I wanted to put under his name, like Jerry Stahl, you know, novelist, writer for CSI. And he said, if you do that, I'm not letting you put this in the movie. He did not, you know, I just put writer or novelist, and he was fine with that. He didn't want the fact that he was a writer for CSI. But it's bizarre to me, and I love his writing on CSI. It's some of the best writing on TV. It's smart. It's funny. It's how people talk. And he writes things like, you know, plots where, like, they have to solve the murder of they found someone who was doing sex changes in, you know, a rent-a-storage unit, and the surgery went wrong, and the person died, and the body was left in there halfway through a sex change. He writes things like that, and he writes things like the one that the parents' groups complained about the most was an episode called King Baby, and it was about a man who was found dead, a middle-aged man who was found dead, dressed in diapers with a baby bonnet on his head and a big lolly in a room in his home, some millionaire who was arrested, who was an infantile kink. Infantilism was his kink. And he had a woman that he would pay to come over and nanny him and treat him like a baby. And he would say goo goo gaga while she, you know, pranced around naked and changed his diapers, and the parents groups were very, very upset by that. And the guy is found dead, like, you know, with LSD in his system or something like that. That's a Jerry plot point.
I'm sitting here kind of panicking in my mind until it dawned on me that this is the Wednesday show. This is not Saturday, and this is not Sunday.
Yeah, it crossed my mind too. I was like, wait, can we go there? Look at this picture second to the bottom of this giant polydactyl cat. It's so awesome. Look at it. You can see all its toes just hanging out there.
I was going to mention that. It's kind of odd to see a cat with extra toes.
They do exist. I mean, it's a lot more common than with people. And apparently Hemingway had a bunch of them and didn't fix them because he was obviously Hemingway would be absolutely against cutting a cat's balls off. You know, he just thought everything should be able to do what it naturally wanted to do. And Hemingway lived somewhere. I don't know if it was the Florida Keys or Cuba, but one of the places he bought a house there were a bunch of feral cats, and he started feeding them, and then they started living, you know, indoor, outdoor in his house and became his cats. And after he died, somebody bred some of them, and there is a lineage. There's a lady that sells Hemingway cats. I have a feeling Jerry might have bought his cats from the Hemingway cat lady, but I don't know it. Just because he has polydactyl cats, Hemingway's known for that. Somebody sells the offspring of those cats, the lineage of those cats, and I would imagine Jerry likes Hemingway because he's that kind of writer.
I see he had one CSI episode that was named Fur and Loathing, and this is a CSI Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's about furry conventioneers, people who like to dress up as animals and rub on each other. Yeah, I think Jerry just sits around in this cavernous mansion looking up kink on Wikipedia and then finding the weirdest kinks he can and saying, that would make a good episode.
I wonder if this one will get me fired. I wonder if this one will get me fired.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I actually asked Jerry for a job reference at one point for to try to get an agent in Hollywood as a screenwriter. And Jerry said, I'll do it for you, but I think that a recommendation for me will work against you, not for you in Hollywood.
Pretty wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the fun part of the day. I think we should go on to the usual kind of fiendy goodness. Do you have the notes I sent you? And look at that picture I sent you. It's narking. There's an app for that. My wife sent me this image that she found somewhere on the internet. It said, Crime Stoppers of Central Wyoming, text a tip. Crime Stoppers, along with the Casper Police Department, has a new method for anonymous crime tip reporting. Text a tip. Download the free Tip Submit ad app from Apple and Android phone for Apple and Android phones. Set a password and select Casper Police Department. You can send a text, picture, or video. So I guess they don't have it for audio yet, so you can't send the Freedom Fiends yet. But I guess you could text to tell them to listen to Freedom Fiends and say, they're taking free speech too far. But isn't this bizarre? Apparently it's an app that a bunch of police agencies have gotten involved with, and you scroll down from the list of what police agency you want preset on your phone to instantly report things the police should know about. Man, wow. Hitler would have loved this. This is, Hitler and Stalin. Okay, let's say Stalin, because people don't like it when you say compare them to Hitler. Stalin liked everyone to narc on everyone, you know, and that's kind of what ran the Soviet Union. Was everyone narking on their neighbors. But now there's an app for that.
Hey, I have some breaking news. This just handed to me.
Did some town legalize marijuana?
Adam Kokesh took a plea deal and is out of jail.
Really? Send me a link. That is breaking news, and that's more important than the inevitability of police agencies having an app for squealing on nannies, nanny app for squealing on people.
I'm not sure there's a link just yet. That was handed to me by the Bad Quaker Newsroom, which is my wife who took a phone call from a person who is, let's say, very close to Kokesh.
Oh no. Okay. Yeah. Let me check this out. Here we go. Gun activist Adam Kokesh pleads guilty to weapon and drug charges. Now wait. There's the second thing below that says Adam Kokesh pleads not guilty to gun charges. What are the details on this? All right. Oh, God, I hate the Examiner. They open up 10. No, I'm not going to look at the Examiner. Adam Kokesh, the libertarian gun activist who loaded a shotgun on D.C. on the 4th of July, has pleaded guilty to weapon and drug charges. Online court records show that he accepted a plea deal today and was released and will be sentenced on January 17th. Kokesh originally planned to defy D.C.'s gun laws by leading a loaded rifle march across Arlington Memorial Bridge. He instead uploaded a video of himself at Freedom Plaza with what appeared to be a loaded shotgun on YouTube. He's been in a D.C. jail since. Let me send you this. I'm tired of reading. No, I'm not tired of reading. I want to share the spotlight with you.
Are you on 4NBC or are you on HuffPo?
No, go ahead and read something.
Okay. Let's see. This one's from the Huffington Post. And liberals. Now I have to stall.
Liberals. Yeah,
I have to stall while it's loading.
Yeah.
Because they have so much advertisements on there.
Ugh.
And this is where we fill in sound because we can't have dead air.
You know, on radio, on GCN, if there's 6 seconds of dead air, alarms go off in the GCN studio, literally. Like, that's, I talked before about how that would have been a fantasy. Like, I've always liked talking and felt that what I have to say is important. And as a child, I would have loved it if you would have told me, you know, in about 30 years, you're going to be in a situation where what you have to say is so important that alarms will go off if you stop talking.
Yeah, so I'll pick up about where you were. It says here that I think you read part of this. D.C. Superior Court records show Kokesh, who filmed the D.C. shotgun video after calling off a planned armed march on Washington, pled guilty to drug and weapons charges on Wednesday and received bond on two conditions: that he not possess weapons of any kind, and that's in quotes, and that he keep away from the district except for court and other legal appointments.
You gotta get out of town, boy.
You gotta get out of town except for court, man. Yeah.
The guilty plea comes as something of a surprise. As the Washington Post notes, the Wednesday hearing was unscheduled and came just weeks after a not guilty plea to the same charges.
You know, it says that he pled guilty to shotgun and marijuana charges. So what happened with the mushrooms? Did they drop that, or did they admit they planted that? I mean, there was conjecture. He said that he didn't have mushrooms in his house, and they found magic mushrooms.
I don't see anything about it in this story.
Well, I'm glad he's out. He was called very dangerous by the presiding judge.
I'm glad he's out, too, because, you know, I hate to think of anybody who is not an actual violent criminal being caged up like that. That makes no sense.
Yeah. Does it say what the next step is here? It doesn't.
I don't see anything other than now I have to try to find it, where they said in January that he'll be sentenced.
Huh. Don't know.
And that's fairly typical. The courts are so slow. They do things like molasses dripping at that speed.
Yeah.
Although I do see over here a news flash off to the side that Bill Nye, the science guy, is in fact not dead.
Who said he was dead?
It's the Huffington Post. They're probably just looking for clicks.
Yeah. I'm just looking at Jerry Stahl's cats. Yeah. You know, if I put in the show notes, Jerry Stahl's cats is something we mentioned, and link these pictures, I'll bet Jerry Stahl will see it and look at it. I could see him doing that.
He probably will.
Yeah. 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 I don't know that he actually edits his Wikipedia page, but somebody edited his Wikipedia page to take off CSI, and he told me he didn't want to be known as being a writer for CSI. But his writing on CSI is so wonderful. It's one of the good things on TV. And I think I think without his writing on CSI, you wouldn't have the show Breaking Bad. I really think that CSI kind of paved the way for that show. You know, I saw a show, an interesting movie the other day. It's called White House Down. Have you seen it?
I have not.
It's a good popcorn flick. It's basically a bunch of terrorists take over the White House under the guise of cable TV installers, and one man has to save the president and the world and America.
Wow.
But the terrorists were like every stock group the writer could think of who don't love Obama and don't love the government, all lumped into one team. Like, the team includes right-wingers, racists. Oh, the president is black, but it's not Obama. It's definitely not Obama, because one of the plot points in it is that the president in this movie wants to bring all the troops home from the Middle East, and the military industrial complex is trying to stop him. And there's actually I don't want to. OK, this is probably if someone's planning on seeing this movie, they should probably fast forward a minute or two. What's it called? What do you call that? Spoiler alert. So there's a vice president. Actually, there's a guy who's in line in succession to the president who is in bed with the military industrial complex, who kind of organizes the coup, working in conjunction with someone from the Secret Service. And there's every stock group that doesn't love the government in the team that takes over the White House. There's like right wingers, racists, anti-Federal Reserve folks, the father of a military member abandoned by the government, two guys with Circle A anarchy tattoos, and just for good measure, a young, weird, hip, former NSA employee turned black hat hacker who basically turned black hat hacker because he doesn't like Apple making money selling MP3s. He tries to hack into the drone systems and point drone missiles at Apple headquarters in California.
Wow.
But before he joins this team. And it turns out, like, okay, like in this movie, every morning the president is given a threat assessment of like people who are very dangerous individuals to the president. And that's something that actually happens. And in this movie, the guy who assembles this team to take over the White House picks his team members from like the scariest of a year of those threat reports. And that's how he ends up with the wide variety of resumes. And one of them is played by one of the guys that's one of the white power guys in Breaking Bad, the guy with the kind of handlebar mustache.
Oh,
I think it's like Jack's brother or something. The main guys, one of the main guys that's not Todd and not Jack.
Yeah. He played a decisive part in the shooting.
Yeah.
Scene.
Yeah. Yeah, but that movie, I mean, yeah, I made a comment after this movie to DJ, and she had a hilarious comment. I said, you know, I just realized in this kind of action movie, the hero is always divorced and estranged from his wife and kid, but in the end, his wife and kid believe in him again. Like, that just comes up over and over and over in that kind of action movie. And DJ said, that's because most Hollywood screenwriters are divorced.
Yeah, and they all secretly wish their wives would come back to them.
Or their
and realize what a wonderful man he
or
is.
Or at least their kids would. Yeah, the wife doesn't always come back to them, but the kid always does. Yeah.
Hollywood I was thinking of a Schwarzenegger movie that goes that way, and then there's the what are those ones with wow. I just walked into a hole there.
Jerry Stahl's divorced, but he doesn't write that kind of action flick. Ever. Which actually he did. He wrote an action flick. See if this is on his Wikipedia page. He wrote Bad Boys 3, which was a giant. That's not on there either.
No, it lists Bad Boys 2.
Oh, Bad Boys 2. I'm sorry. Yeah, he wrote Bad Boys 2, which is what a Jerry Bruckheimer, like, you know, Will Smith over the top buddy cop comedy with that
Martin
movie.
Lawrence.
Yeah, that movie is notable because I think it breaks the previously held record for most police cars destroyed in one movie, which was previously held by
the Blues Brothers.
Right. But this movie has a scene where there's like more police cars destroyed than that. Plus like a bunch of boats on the highway, like boats that are being towed in Miami and like fly off of cars onto another freeway and then get hit by oncoming police cars. It's a pretty awesome scene. And in typical Jerry Stahl fashion, there's a scene in that movie where one of the cops played by Martin Lawrence accidentally gets dosed with ecstasy while in a morgue and starts like looking at corpses and like, ooh, she's kind of hot. Yeah, that's like the ultimate kind of like example of Jerry Stahl's kind of scenarios is a cop on ecstasy in a morgue checking out the hot dead chicks.
Wow.
Yeah, man. I wish TV were more like his writing. I wish he would quit being ashamed of being a TV writer and embrace it, you know?
Yeah, but I don't know.
Although it's kind of cool that he's what every screenwriter wants to be, and he doesn't admit he's a screenwriter. That's kind of cool.
It would kind of force the bar up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you want to talk about this guy that was butt raped by the police in Albuquerque? Did you hear about that?
I did not see that one.
Really? Really? Yeah, it was HuffPo anal search. I will search HuffPo anal search. Yeah. All right. Here you go. It's the first thing that comes up when you search HuffPo anal search, apparently. Let's see. David Ecker appears to clench his buttocks at a traffic stop. Cops order enemas, colonoscopy, x-rays for non-existent drugs. This was a guy in Albuquerque who was leaving a Walmart, failed to fully stop at a red light, and the cops pulled him over. He was scratching his butt or clenched or something, and so they ordered him for, like, let's take a little break and go to the market and come back. It'll give you a chance to read up on this.
Okay.
This is Nima Vedati from the Freedom Fiends. Using government-printed funny money fuels and encourages wars abroad and the wars at home against you and all you hold dear. Why should you remain beholden to self-appointed federal kings who don't care if you starve in a cage? Become your own king today by owning gold and silver from Midas Resources. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Midas Resources banner over on the right, or go to gold.freedomfiends.com. That's gold.freedomfiends.com.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, fights to protect your rights in the digital world. When a patent troll threatened podcasters, they fought back. EFF has also defended your right to encryption and has sued the NSA to end the government's mass, suspicionless surveillance. There are different ways you can help EFF, from donations, to signing petitions, to writing your representatives, to just spreading the word. Find out more at EFF.org. That's EFF.org.
Yeah, that's a pretty horrible story, isn't it?
That is unbelievable. Actually, it's, you know, it's entirely believable.
Read a little bit of the highlights of it. So if people didn't hear the 2 hours on Free Talk Live about this the other day, they'll have an inkling of what we're talking about.
David Eckert's attorney recently filed a federal lawsuit on his behalf over the January 3rd incident in which police and doctors co-opted an unethical 14-hour series of cavity searches. Court documents state that Eckert was driving out of Walmart in Deming when he failed to fully stop at the parking lot stop sign.
Deming, New Mexico. It's near Albuquerque. Yep.
He was immediately pulled over, and when he stepped out of his vehicle, an officer reported that he appeared to be clenching his buttocks. That fact was cited as probable cause to suspect Eckert was hiding narcotics in his anal cavity. Officers obtained a search warrant. See, so it was entirely constitutional.
Yeah.
Officers obtained a search warrant, and Eckert's humiliating examination began at a nearby medical center.
Read the list. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I wonder how a doctor justifies this to himself.
Well, originally, they took him to the hospital and demanded he be butt searched, and a doctor refused on moral grounds, on, you know, violating the Hippocratic Oath, and they went to another doctor. They found a doctor who would violate the Hippocratic Oath, and I would say several amendments in the Bill of Rights, including, like, I don't know, I would say the Eighth Amendment, too, not just the Fourth and search and seizure, but the Eighth with, you know, cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, before even being convicted, he... Read the list here of what happened to him. It's mind-blowing.
Let's see. One, Eckert's abdominal area was x-rayed. No narcotics were found. Two, Doctors then performed an exam of Eckert's anus with their fingers. No narcotics were found. Three. Doctors performed a second exam of Eckert's anus with their fingers. No narcotics were found. Four. Doctors penetrated Eckert's anus to insert an enema. Eckert was forced to defecate in front of doctors and police officers. Eckert watched as doctors searched his stool. No narcotics were found. Five. Doctors penetrated Eckert's anus to insert an enema a second time. Eckert was forced to defecate in front of doctors and police officers. Eckert watched as doctors searched his stool. No narcotics were found. Six. Doctors penetrated Eckert's anus to insert
this
an enema a third time.
This sounds like a Jerry Stahl script in a CSI. I mean, this is so bizarre. I can't believe this is real. Keep going.
Eckert was forced to defecate in front of doctors and police officers. Eckert watched as doctors searched his stool a third time. No narcotics were found. Seven. Doctors then x-rayed Eckert again. No narcotics were found. And eight. Doctors prepared Eckert for surgery and sedated him and then performed a colonoscopy where a scope with a camera was inserted into Eckert's anus, rectum, colon, and into his large intestines. No narcotics were found.
Ugh. And, okay, he was protesting the whole time. There was no consent. And he was sent a bill by the hospital. Although, under Obamacare, I think that this will be free. Yeah, I just had to try my new, I put all the little like music things that we play on the show. I usually play them on my computer and just put the mic up to the speaker, but I thought it would sound better if I put them on my old iPod and played them through the mixer. So that was my first test of that. Yay.
That is just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And that is what happens when you vote for the lesser of that is the result of 200 years of voting for the lesser of two evils of, you know, well, you can't vote for the Republicans because they want the war on drugs. So I got to vote for the Democrats, and you can't vote for the Democrats because they want to steal all your money for more police, you know, whatever. It's like this is what happens when you vote for people. And there's no one you can vote for to stop this except Ron Paul. And people tried that, and the Republicans wouldn't back him because, you know, I actually called this radio station the other day and was talking about our show and trying to get them to put the show on. And the guy was like, he was young, he was kind of hip sounding. He said he was kind of conservative though. And I was like, yeah, we play on a lot of conservative stations. We're libertarian, though. And he's like, well, I listened to your demo, and I kind of like it, but I need to hear a whole show because I want to make sure you're not too libertarian. And I felt like screaming at him. I'm like, what? You want to make sure that we want, like, some intrusion but not no intrusion? Like, would you think that if your butt was searched for scratching your ass at a traffic stop and, you know, what do you want? What's too libertarian? Like, you think there should be no butt searching, but you think this is too much? They should have stopped at the fifth or sixth butt penetration. What do you think? What is too libertarian?
You know, but you have to, I'm sure I haven't scrolled down and read the comments, but knowing how the internet is, I'm sure somewhere in the comments, eventually somebody's going to say, yes, but think of the poor police officers who had to stand there and witness this.
That would exist somewhere, but I read this on HuffPo and I read about 30 comments and they were generally pretty horrified. Everybody was, but it generated into an argument of left versus right. Like one or the other is the answer to prevent this. It was pretty typical HuffPo.
Sad.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have more on this or do you want to go off with something kind of upbeat and fun?
Yeah. Let's move away from Eckert's anus.
Okay. Go to the show notes that I sent you. Go to page 3. I want to have you read something kind of long. It's, let's see, one, but I love Ben Stone's reading. And if you get tired, I can take over. But there is this paper called Crime and Puzzlement, which is written in 1990 by John Perry Barlow, who was the co-lyricist of the Grateful Dead. He's a libertarian Wyoming millionaire who I've never met and probably won't because he's kind of reclusive. I wrote him once and asked him for an interview, and he never wrote back, which doesn't mean anything. Could have gone into a spam folder. Who knows? But, you know, he is the co-founder of the EFF, who we've been have you been playing that on your shows, the EFF ad that I made, Ben?
I have.
Yep. Good. Yeah, the EFF are good people, Electronic Frontier Foundation. I think that without them, the internet would be illegal by now, or it would just be mandatory and it would only be government websites that would probably work as well as Obamacare. So this is he wrote a like 27-page rambling psychedelic writing treatise called Crime and Puzzlement on why he started the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
And I have some bad news for you, Michael.
What's that?
I don't have Word documents on this computer, so I can't open a Word document.
So I'm going to send it to you as an email, because if I send it to you, Liz Cheney, spawn of Darth Cheney. That's what I read recently. Not in this, but somewhere. Spawn of Darth Cheney. You know, she's trying to run for president. That's why she's trying to challenge she's trying to run for senator or congressman of Wyoming, and is taking heat from everybody, including Republicans, because she's trying to knock out a Republican longtime congressman that people like here, Mike Enzi. I don't like him because he was in favor of that tax on the internet, and his reason was because it would protect Wyoming brick and mortar businesses. And I'm like, that's like somebody putting a tax on buggy whips to prevent cars, you know, back in the day.
Right.
So John Perry Barlow wrote this like 26-page treatise on why he had to start the EFF. And I picked out about 4 pages of paragraphs that I think really sum up this document. And I'm going to link it and people should go read it. But it's pretty mind-blowing. It's about this thing called Operation Sun Devil and some other raid in 1990. This is like, there were raids on internet hackers, supposedly. And you have to understand that, like, the internet started in the 70s and was only the purview of the military, the government, basically the military and college universities. Like, those are the only people on the internet. And back then, the internet was really hard to use. You had to be a scientist to use it, and you had to pay a lot of money per minute for the phone, long distance phone charges to use it. It was text only, sending files only. There wasn't a graphic portion of it. The graphic thing that we call the World Wide Web, the internet was invented by a bunch of people back in the 70s and over time. The World Wide Web was invented by one guy in Switzerland. Yeah, and it was basically invented to be able to publish physics papers for peer review. It was invented by a guy working at CERN, the people who later got well known for, everyone thought they were going to end the world with the Large Hadron Collider, Large Hadron Collider, as I call it. And they had a bunch of scientists there at this campus of facilities that all brought their own personal computers in 1989, 1990, that all had different operating systems and they couldn't talk to each other. And so he invented the World Wide Web as a way of sharing information. What's that guy's name? Do you remember?
I don't recall his name.
I've actually wrote him a fan email once and thanked him, and he wrote me back. World Wide Web history. Tim Berners-Lee is a British man, and one guy invented the web. And it was basically to share physics research for peer review. And that's kind of interesting, I think, that was what it was invented for. And then it spread to everybody, including us being able to do podcatting from our bedrooms.
And kitty cat pictures.
Yeah, and kitty cat pictures. So you have to realize, though, in 1990, now this wasn't the FBI raiding people. This was the Secret Service raiding hackers because There were two raids, and they're like groups of raids. Like, they raided a bunch of people around the country all on the same day, like they love to do. And Operation Sun Devil, which was named because it was out of the FBI headquarters in Arizona next to Sun Devil Stadium, was raiding a bunch of people that all knew each other. That was their only crime, because somebody had shared on a bulletin board system. Now, you have to understand, this is like the web was being invented probably this same month or same season of 1990, but people didn't really know about it yet. So these guys were sharing stuff on bulletin board systems, which is where you would dial a computer with an acoustic modem coupler. You know, you'd dial a number and put your phone handset in a thing with a microphone and a speaker that cost a lot of money, and it would really slowly transmit data. So there was this guy who had hacked into AT&T and copied, not stolen, not damaged. He'd copied like a 3-page paper on internal organization chart planning. It was nothing that was like top secret, that should be top secret. It was nothing that could be used to hurt AT&T in any way. And it was in really dry, you know, corporate org chart speak. And he brought it out like, oh, my prize that I went. I went to this strange land and I brought back proof that I was there. And he shared it with his friends. And Operation Sun Devil was the Secret Service kicking in the doors of people who had a copy of that and taking all of their equipment, and not just their computers, but like telephone answering machines, you know, guitar amplifiers, anything that plugged in that wasn't a light. They took. And then there was a second raid the same year where Barlow was raided. And what he was being raided for was having a tiny bit of code of the Apple operating system that someone at Apple had anonymously copied and sent out. And it wasn't anything that could be used to replicate, you know, Apple computers. It wasn't a big part of the system. It was a tiny part of the graphics interface, and it was code. And like the people raiding his house didn't know what they were getting, and he had to explain to the agents raiding him what they were taking. And that's when he decided he had to start the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So let's do a long reading of this. Say go if you get to a point where you want to pass it off to me. All right.
Oh, okay. Now we start with the
fact that
the warrant referred to cyberspace as hyperspace.
Yes.
And okay, so the first one here is, in fairness, one can imagine the government's problem. This is all pretty magical stuff to them. If I were trying to terminate the operations of a witch coven, I'd probably seize everything in sight. How would I tell the ordinary household broom from the getaway vehicle? But as I heard more and more about the vile injustices being heaped on my young pals in the League of Doom, not to mention the unfortunate folks nearby, the less I was inclined towards such temperate thoughts as these. I drifted back to the 60s style sense of the government, thinking of a thing of monolithic and evil efficiency, and adopting an up against the wall willingness to spit out words like pig or fascist into my descriptions. In doing so, I endowed the Secret Service with a clarity of intent which no government, which no agency of the government will ever possess. despite almost every experience I've ever had with federal authorities, I keep imagining its competence.
It's lack of competence, yeah. Which we say often is that, like, the great saving grace of the government is its inefficiency and incompetence. But go on.
Poor Agent Baxter didn't know a ROM chip from a vice grip when he arrived. So much of the time was spent trying to educate him on the nature of the thing which had been stolen, or whether stolen was even the right term for what had happened to it. Things have rather jumped the groove when potential suspects must explain to law enforcers the nature of their alleged perpetrations. This kind of reminds me of Larkin Rose telling about when his house was raided.
Yeah.
They had absolutely no idea what they were looking for, and they're just like, you know, digging around having no clue.
I wouldn't swear Agent Baxter ever got it quite right. after I showed him some actual source code, gave him a demonstration of email in action, and downloaded a file from the world, from the Well, which was a internet access group started by the author of the editor of the Whole Earth Catalog. He took to rubbing his face with both hands, peering up over his fingertips and saying, "It sure is something, isn't it?" Or "Woo-wee." Or "My 8-year-old knows more about these things than I do." He didn't say that with a father's pride so much as an immigrant's fear of a strange new land into which he will be forcibly moved and his own child is a native. He looked across my keyboard into cyberspace and didn't like what he saw. Actually, the question of the source code was another area where worlds but shadow boxed. Although Agent Baxter didn't know source code from Tuesday, he did know that Apple Computer had told his agency that what had been stolen and disseminated was the complete recipe for a Macintosh computer. The distribution of this secret formula might result in the creation of millions of Macintoshes not made by Apple, and of course, the ruination of Apple Computer. In my world, new Prometheus, whoever they or more likely he might be, had distributed a small portion of the code which related specifically to Color QuickDraw. QuickDraw is Apple's name for software which controls Mac's on-screen graphics. But this was another detail which Agent Baxter could not capture. For all he knew, you could grow Macintoshes from floppy disks.
Amazing.
I explained to him that Apple was alleging something like the ability to assemble an entire human being from the recipe for a foot. See, that's why Jerry Stahl brings a foot with him to readings. But even he knew that analogy was inexact. And trying to get him to accept the idea that a corporation could go mad with suspicion was quite futile. He had a far different perception of the emotional reliability of institutions. This was Kafka in a clown suit. I love this guy's writing. That's why I'm reading this. But of course, incompetence is a double-edged banana.
And the banana is there for comedy relief, folks.
I'm a member of that half of the human race which is inclined to divide the human race into two kinds of people. My dividing line runs between the people who crave certainty and the people who trust chance. Larger organizations and their drones, he's speaking of people there, the thing that bombs you from over your house didn't really exist yet then. Larger organizations and their drones huddle on one end of my scale, busily trying to impose predictable homogeneity on messy circumstance. On the other end, freelancers and ne'er-do-wells cavort about, getting on by luck if they get by at all. However you cast these poles, it comes down to the difference between those who see life as a struggle against cosmic peril and human infamy, and those who believe without any hard evidence that the universe is actually on our side. Fear versus faith. I'm in the latter group. In spite of the fact that this system works very reliably for me and my kind, I find we're increasingly in the minority. All right, you go, Ben.
I have a number of theories as to why this is happening. One has to do with the opening of cyberspace. As a result of this development, humanity is now undergoing the most profound transformation in its history. Coming into the virtual world, we inhabit information. Indeed, we become information. Thought. I need my glasses on to do this. Thought is embodied and the fresh is made.
Okay, stop.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Why don't you go get your glasses, Ben? I'm going to read till you come back with glasses. Just say something when you come back.
Okay, go ahead.
All right? Thought is embodied and the flesh is made word. It's weird as hell. Beginning with the invention of the telegraph and extending through television into virtual reality, we have been, for over a century, experiencing a terrifying erosion in our sense of both body and place. As we begin to realize the enormity of what is happening to us all but the most courageous have gotten scared. And everyone, regardless of his psychic resilience, feels this overwhelming sense of strangeness. The world, once so certain and tangible and legally precise, has become an infinite layering of opinions, perceptions, litigation, camera angles, data, white noise, and most of all, ambiguities. Those of us who are of the fearful persuasion do not like ambiguities. Indeed, if one were a little jumpy to start with, he may now be fairly humming with nameless dread. Since no one likes his dread to be nameless, the first order of business is to find it some names. You back, Ben?
Yeah, I finally caught up with you.
Okay. For a long time here in the United States, communism provided a kind of catch-all boogeyman. Marx, Stalin, and Mao summoned forth such a specter that, to many Americans, annihilation of life was preferable to the human's portion, to the human portion becoming communist. But as Big Red wizened and lost his teeth, we began to cast about for a replacement. Go, Ben, go.
Finding none of sufficient individual horror, we have draped a number of objects with that old black bunting which once shrouded the Kremlin. Our current spooks are terrorists, child abductors, AIDS, and the underclass. I would say drugs, but anyone who thinks that the war on drugs is actually a war on,
is not actually a war on the underclass
hasn't been paying close enough attention. There are a couple of problems with these four horsemen. For one thing, they aren't actually very dangerous. For example, only 7 Americans died in worldwide terrorist attacks in 1987. Fewer than 10 out of about 70 million children are abducted by strangers in the U.S. each year. Your chances of getting AIDS if you are neither gay nor a hemophiliac nor a junkie are considerably less than your chances of getting killed by lightning while golfing. The underclass is dangerous, of course, but only, with very few exceptions, if you are a member of it. And you got to remember, this was written, you know, at a time.
1990. Yeah.
Yeah. When AIDS, the fear of AIDS was just crazy back then.
Yeah.
The other problem with these perils is that they are all physical. If we are entering into a world in which no one has a body, physical threats begin to lose their sting. And now I come to the point of this screed. The perfect screed, the perfect boogeyman of modern times is the cyberpunk. He is so smart, he makes you feel even more stupid than you usually do. He knows this complex country in which you're permanently lost.
Oh, I want to add that we're looking for a Python programmer, not to do any hacking, but to make something. I guess that's hacking, not to do any cracking or anything illegal. So if you're a Python computer programmer, write us at talkback@freedomfiends.com. Okay, go ahead, Ben.
He understands the value of things you can't conceptualize long enough to cash in on. He is the one-eyed man in the country of the blind. Oh, I love that metaphor. In the land of the blind, a one-eyed man can be king. Perhaps the most frightening thing about the cyberpunk is the danger he presents to the institution, whether corporate or governmental. If you are frightened, you have almost certainly taken shelter by now in one of those collective organisms. So the very last thing you want is something which can endanger your heretofore unassailable hive. And make no mistake, crackers will become to bureaucratic bodies what viruses present to the human bodies.
Crackers here means hackers. It means people who are smart and can get in a computer system. It doesn't mean white folk.
Right. Like hacker, but someone who can crack into a system.
Well, I think lately Edward Snowden is the perfect example of what he's talking about. And do note that in that movie White House Down, which just came out, there's a character that's basically Snowden, the hacker that they've hired in the White House, who's trying to, okay, this is, cover your ears if you still want to see the movie and haven't seen it, the one who is hacking the launch codes of the nukes to wipe the Middle East off of the map for the head of the Secret Service. Is a former NSA guy who kind of looks like Snowden and doesn't like copyright. And remember that there's that famous picture of Snowden with his laptop. There's two stickers on the top of his laptop, and one is for the EFF, the organization that this document we're reading excerpts from is basically their declaration of independence. So go on.
There's a big word here I'm not sure I can do.
Ambiguophobes?
Yeah.
Okay, go on.
Defining the conceptual and legal map of cyberspace before the ambiguophobes do it for us with punitive over-precision is going to require some effort. We can't expect the Constitution to take care of itself. Indeed, the precedent for mitigating the constitutional protection of a new medium has already been established. Consider what happened to radio in the early part of this century, and that being that the Constitution was blown out the window and the government took over.
Yeah, in the early 1930. Yep.
New media, like any chaotic system...
You skipped a paragraph. Under the pretext of allocating limited bandwidth, the government established an early right to censorship over broadcast content, which still seems directly unconstitutional to me, except that it stuck. And now, owing to a large body of case law, looks to go on sticking. All right, take over.
New media, like any chaotic system, are highly sensitive to initial conductions.
Conditions.
Wow. I can't blame that on my glasses today.
It's getting late in the day. You read better earlier in the day.
Yeah.
And you don't usually do stuff that's you don't get to run over it with a razor blade. But I'll do a little bit of that, but maybe not.
Today's answers for the moment become tomorrow's permanent institutions of both law and expectation. Thus, they bear examination with the dense...
With that destiny with that, in mind. While I previously had no stake in the obscure conundrum of free telecommunications, I was, thanks to Operation Sun Devil, suddenly able to plot a trajectory from the current plight of the Legion of Doom, that's the name of the hacker organization, to an external constraint on opinions much dearer to me. I remembered Martin Niemöller, who said, in Germany, they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak up. I decided it was time for me to speak up, and that's when he started the EFF.
Now, keeping in mind that in 1990, people didn't quote that. I mean, that's fairly commonly quoted
nowadays. I think people
nowadays.
Quote it because he quoted it. Because I've seen a lot of computer people quote that, and I think it's because he quoted it. And, Niemöller was a Lutheran pastor in Germany who was originally pro-Hitler during Hitler's takeover, and then became very anti-Hitler and very anti-war and was thrown in a concentration camp and almost killed. And that's a really good statement, his first they came. And it kind of applies, I think, to why we're doing what we're doing right now. You know, why I'm not doing something else right now, today, this afternoon, when there's other things I have to do. And Nima's busy. I could have easily said, oh, well, we'll just skip a Wednesday. It's not the radio show. It's not that important. But it is that important. And we have to speak up. We have to keep speaking up to anyone who'll listen, regardless of whether anyone's listening. And we do it because we have to, man. We may get thrown in jail for it. We may not. Some people do. Some people don't. Friends of ours have. But we're going to keep talking.
And it's not just... You know, we're not just defending the things that are of interest to us. I don't smoke marijuana. I don't take any illegal drugs. I know, Michael, you don't either. And yet we recognize that the war on drugs is a war on people. We see that. We see that it's also a gateway to the war on guns, that one is intricately connected to the other, and they are inseparable. One funds the other.
Yeah. And he talks in this document, I mean, we read like 3 pages of this 26-page document. It was from the beginning, middle, and end of it. I took out parts that kind of summarized it. But he talks in this document about how when this kid first got arrested for copying this AT&T thing and disseminating it to 8 of his friends on dial-up modems, it got written about in the mainstream press a lot. And the mainstream press did not see cyberspace or the internet as a free speech thing. And these are newspapers that, like, at the top of their banner, next to the name of the newspaper, they'll have quotes about free speech, you know. and the First Amendment. And they all threw these kids to the wolves. I mean, one paper even said about this kid hacking into AT&T and removing this piece of paper that he could have, like, accidentally or intentionally cut off all the 911 service in the country, which is ridiculous. He wasn't even in that computer bank system. He was in, and that's locally, and he wasn't doing anything like that. He was basically rifling through their boring files of organizational, you know, how the org chart is made. And they, one paper actually said, well, I hope he's sufficiently punished and at least no one died from his actions.
Inferring that somebody could have.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they painted him in the mainstream press as a complete horrible hacker, and isn't it great that the Secret Service arrested him and, you know, will punish him efficiently?
Well, you heard that with Snowden and with Manning both. There are all these inferences that, well, we have troops in the field and they're endangering the lives of troops. And absolutely no evidence is brought forth that that's the case.
Well, also, and also the first guy, what was the first guy? The military guy? Not Snowden.
Oh,
Bradley Manning.
Yeah,
Manning. I mean, with Bradley Manning, people could sort of make that inference, but there's no way to make that with Snowden. And people are still making that inference with Snowden. Like, it's national security. Lives are at stake. And it's like, no, they aren't. All he did was said, the government can directly spy on your private Facebook and YouTube and, you know, Gmail conversations, which everyone who's smart kind of knew anyway. I mean, I've been assuming that forever. Like, a year before the Snowden thing came out, you and I would be talking on the phone and be half jokingly, half seriously. Like, whenever you would say something that could be taken as by an idiot in a cubicle who doesn't know what cyberspace is, but it's his job to spy on it, as terroristic thought, I would clarify it and say on the phone to you, I was clarifying it for that guy. Like, when you'd say, you know, I used to be in a band called Bomb. And when you would say something like, well, yeah, maybe you should send that guy, you know, the link to Bomb, he might like it, I'd say, I want to clarify for the NSA guy listening in a cubicle that we are talking about my rock band Bomb, not an actual bomb. I would say that half jokingly, but half seriously, because I assumed that our phone call was being recorded, if not directly monitored. And that was a year or two before anyone knew who Snowden was, you know. Let's take a break and go to the market, Ben.
Let's go.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. Federal Reserve notes only have value because of a collective hallucination, whereas gold and silver are real, and so is their value. Gold and silver predate government-printed funny money, and they will undoubtedly outlive government-printed funny money. Get some gold and silver into your hands from Midas Resources by going to freedomfiends.com right now and clicking on the Midas Resources banner over on the right. Or go to gold.freedomfiends.com. That's gold.freedomfiends.com.
Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Hey, this is Squizzcar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom's Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now. So there you go.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. but they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
So, Ben, you have a story about government surveillance. Go.
I have a few. one really recent story came from 2013. A person very close to me, and you know, I know this person good. Okay, I'll say whoever's hearing this that might be concerned would know who it is anyway. So it's my brother, and he works in the aerospace industry like I used to. And he was telling me this story. He retired from the company that he was with, and he set up his own company and then went back into the original company as a contractor, as a private consultant. So he's pretty much doing the same job that he's done for years, but now it's his company that he's doing it. And so in doing that, he set up a home office, did everything, you know, legally so that he could have part of his home for a tax write-off, and he got a separate phone line coming in, and he got a separate account and a separate Time Warner cable accounts so that he could have his internet connection there at high speed internet through them. And he had his phone through Time Warner as well. And then, and so he has all that for his business. Now, his wife, totally separate from him, has a cell phone account with one of the major carriers, and I can't remember which one, but she has a family account where she and the two children and my brother all have separate phones on her account. And she's had that account for several years. So his company accounts were all separate from her family accounts and through a separate carrier. So one day they go to the mall, and my brother didn't necessarily want to go in the mall. So he decided to stay outside in his truck and give my sister a call in Eastern Kentucky. So he uses his cell phone sitting in the mall parking lot, and he makes about an hour-long call to my sister, and they're just chatting about typical brother-sister stuff. And actually, my dad had died about 4 months earlier, so there was a discussion in regards to, you know, how they're taking care of all the arrangements and everything like this. And after about an hour of talking to my sister, his wife comes out of the mall. And so he says, okay, well, I'm going to hang up now. Here's my wife. And then they drove home. And when they got home, he saw that he had a message on his company phone. And so he played that message. And it was the hour-long phone call that he had made to my sister on the cell phone, on his wife's cell phone account through a separate carrier. So that means there was something connecting these two together. And I don't have the note in front of me, but I actually looked around through the internet, and I found a company advertising software that security, specifically targeting security agencies, police forces, and different governmental security agencies around the world that actually performs exactly that. It connects multiple accounts from different sources and connects them all together so that the spying agency can pretty much connect all the dots, no matter how many accounts you have, and even if they're under your wife's name or whatever. This company offers that software, and my brother actually had the recording there as proof of it. And my brother knows a guy really well that's in the DEA, and so he went to this friend in the DEA and he said, "You wouldn't believe what just happened." And he told him the story. And the DEA agent looked at him with a straight face and said, "Oh, no, that couldn't have happened. We don't work that way."
Wow.
And he's like, "Dude, you don't understand. I can show you the recording."
Wow. Pretty bizarre, man.
Yeah. Working in the depths of the aerospace industry, though, and this is going back in the 90s and up into the early 2000s, pre 9/11. We pretty much all knew all the time that our phones, including our home phones, were tapped constantly. And there were little pieces of evidence that would support that.
Like what?
Conversations that you would have with other engineers or with different people around, that all of a sudden your boss would have some information that conversation took place, even though you had told your boss.
Wow.
in one case, I was down in the depths, what we called the catacombs, which is a series of bunker underneath underground chambers, tunnels. I don't know how to put it any other way. It was made blast proof for World War II, so it's underneath a jet engine manufacturing plant, and there's several depths down underneath there. And I used to work down in there in what we called the catacombs, and I knew that my office phone was regularly listened to, and I wanted to make a private call to my brother who was in the same facility. So I thought, well, I'll just go out to the payphone and give him a call. So I walked down the hall to the bathrooms, and there's a payphone on the wall. And so I called my brother from there, and while I was talking to him, I looked into the handset, and I actually saw something inside where the earpiece goes in. And so while I'm talking to him, I carefully unscrewed, you know, this is the old time phones with the mouthpiece and the earpiece that screwed off of it. And so I screwed that off and looked, and there's this little orange dot that looked like a little bit smaller than a penny, about the thickness of a penny, with a wire coming off of
it. Wow.
And the wire wasn't hooked to anything. The wire just went down the handle of the phone, and I could lift it out and hold on to it while I was talking to my brother. It's a tiny little, you know, it's a little bug that they had in the
handset. Yeah.
Handset, yeah. So I carefully finished my conversation, closed it back up, hung up, walked to the other side of the plant upstairs and into my brother's office and told him what I had just found. And he said, well, thanks for telling them. There's probably one in this room right now listening to.
Yeah.
So it was an ongoing thing, you know.
Yep. Wow. So I was reading this thing the other day about Snowden asking for clemency. Like, he filed a former request with America for clemency, which I guess makes sense in his situation, and it's probably something he has to do and be turned down before he can seek asylum officially, permanently in another country. But Dianne Feinstein said, Snowden should have reported his concerns privately to me, and I'd have taken care of them.
And by taking care of them, is that in the mafia sense?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But
Bruno, take care of this.
The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Mike Rogers, called clemency for Snowden a terrible idea. And I read that and I was like, Mike Rogers, that sounds familiar. And I'm like, oh, yeah, we talked about him the other day. He's the guy that's been caught putting toilet cams in the ladies' bathroom in his office in the Capitol building.
Was he the one that made the statement that if you don't know you're being
yes.
spied on, then
yes.
you're not harmed?
Yeah, I guess he's harmed because he found out Snowden was spying on his spying. But I guess I didn't know that guy was the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. I guess he thinks there's something of national security happening in the ladies' toilet at his office.
And then there's the oldest possible joke right there, that there is such a thing as House Intelligence.
Ugh. Well, I guess the government is concerned with your toilet habits. They seem to be concerned with what's in your butt, considering that one guy's search.
Over and over and over.
Yep.
Over.
So I want to close with something kind of funny that we realized the other day. Was I wrote to you a long time ago and talked to you about helping your audio quality, and we're having some problems with it today, but we'll fix them. It's something about how we're transmitting it over the internet, but your audio is generally a lot better on your podcast than it was before you and I started talking and I gave you equipment recommendations. And I wrote to you about 3 months before I wrote to you again and you actually wrote me back. You know, we started our relationship with me writing you and you going, ugh. You thought it was spam, right?
I probably did. I don't actually remember the email that came in, But you get so many that say things like, "Hi, I'm Jerry. I can help you with that SEO." Or
yeah, and they always kind of personalize it in a general machine generated way. Like, "I'm a fan of the Bad Quaker podcast. It is the coolest thing I've heard in a long time," which is probably what I said. And you probably thought it was spam and deleted it. And I was thinking, maybe I should have put, "I'm a fellow anarcho-capitalist like you." And then you probably would have realized maybe this isn't spam and read it. But what I'm envisioning is a world where being an anarcho-capitalist is such a common thing that spam would contain that. That's the world I'm looking for, where being an ANCAP is so common and prevalent that people put that in spams to get people's attention.
I can kind of see that now. Hi, I see you hate the government. I hate the government also.
Well, that would be a lot more general and probably work better than I'm an anarcho-capitalist, because a lot of people hate the government who are not anarcho-capitalists. I don't hate the government. I just want it to go away. I don't wish it ill will. I don't wish ill will to any member of it. I just want them to stop doing it and go spend time with their families and have a real life.
I kind of got into an argument with a very prominent economist over the phrasing of hate, whether or not hate was an appropriate thing. And I pointed, I will be the first to admit that I probably don't have a normally functioning brain. But I pointed out to him that, well, his complaint against me was that I had used the word hate. And he said, "You can't think straight when you hate. Hate distorts the mind." And I agree to, like, 99% of the time that's probably true, but I have the ability to sort of turn off the emotion and continue the hate. And so I can be in very I used to be in a rescue squad and I've seen a lot of really bad things, and I have the ability to turn off the emotion part of my feelings that would cause me to overreact or do something stupid, while still maintaining the thoughts of how horrible what I'm seeing is, or how distasteful what I'm seeing is, or in some cases even how much I deeply dislike the person that I'm helping at that particular moment. But I was still able to turn those emotions off and continue to doing what I was there to do, to finish the job. And I kind of felt that way. I feel that way with the word hate. I can, I don't hate the people in government. I realize that the vast majority of them are very confused, very disillusioned, very delusional, and they don't necessarily understand what it is they're doing. So there's no profit to me in hating the individuals or wanting any kind of vengeance against those individuals. And yet I can hate the product of government, the wealth destruction, the destruction of human life, the whole scarring of humanity that comes with the existence of government. I can hate that and not hate those individuals, so that I think I can look in a more calm way at the individual and not hate the postman or not hate the TSA agent or not hate the cop as they're doing the horrible things that they're doing.
Worms. I wholeheartedly concur, Ben Stone, and thank you for coming on the Freedom Fiends. And people should go buy Freedom Fiends buttons and go to freedomfiends.com, and they should go to badquaker.com and check out Ben Stone's much more organized and thought out and well-edited ramblings, and get his T-shirts and other swag. And I would like to thank the listeners for listening today. Worms.
Worms.
Hello, Freedom Fiends. It's your boy Dean from the U.S. Get the U.S. out my bloodstream. I owe me and that includes endorphins. No one won't ask permission and I won't say please. Freedom fans, one fact that I gotta make clear.
The Freedom Fiends podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 3.0 license. Do what you want with it and spread it around. Tell two friends. Make copies. Email it to everyone you know. Go on the site and comment. This is a conversation. Three times a week, Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati share their own unique take on the way the world works and how to find your place in it. available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com. Subscribe and tell two friends.
And remember, the only power they have is the power you allow them. We're not saying the Freedom Fiends are the one true path to anarchist liberation, but it's a good one. If you want to put your voluntarist money where your mouth is, consider making a donation to the Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post. Then make a one-time gift via PayPal or set up a monthly contribution of as little as $3. Giving to the Freedom Fiends helps advance education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. The Freedom Fiends. We work hard, so send us some money.
If you like tranny hookers and shooting crocodile, tune in to freedomfiends.com.